A warning before we start. This podcast discusses child abuse and neglect, and there will be strong language.
Here's what I almost guarantee is going to happen. I'm going to go to court on the 8th, and either A, my attorney has yet to receive discovery or receives it right before court, so we have no time to go over any of this. Guarantee it.
It's been about a month since Children's Services took Teresa Fogel's children. Now, her day in court is finally approaching. The adjudication. The trial that determines whether the agency can actually prove the allegations against her. If not, she gets her kids back. Only, her attorney is missing something really important. From WOUB News, this is episode 5 of 150 Days. I'm Teo Peck Suzuki.
And I'm David Forrester. If you haven't listened to the other episodes, we suggest you do. It might be hard to follow what's going on otherwise.
The thing Teresa's lawyer is missing is discovery. And that's a really big deal.
Discovery is all the evidence lawyers plan to use in court. They're required to share that evidence with one another ahead of time. So Teresa's attorney not having Children's Services discovery is a big problem. He can't mount a defense if he doesn't know what evidence the agency plans to present. Teresa's attorney is a man named John Getson, and Teresa's been having other issues with him. For example, she can't get him to meet with her in person, even though she has all this documentation of her own that she wants to show him. Teresa being Teresa, she doesn't just let that stand. She asks the judge to appoint her another attorney, but he encourages her to stick with John. She agrees, but nothing changes.
Here's a quick recap of where Teresa is in the child welfare process. First, Children's Services takes her kids on June 25th, 2022. The agency alleges a bunch of things, including Teresa's boyfriend has threatened the children, there's no food in the house, and the family struggles with homelessness. There's an initial hearing on these allegations on June 27th, the shelter care hearing, where the burden of proof is really low, and Teresa, like most parents in this situation, doesn't have a lawyer. A month or so goes by, a very stressful and painful month for Teresa and her two daughters, and finally, on August 8th, it's time for the adjudication.
In theory, the adjudication is the best opportunity for most parents to dispute the allegations against them. They can request a trial before the judge, in which the agency has to prove the allegations by clear and convincing evidence. A much higher burden of proof than at the shelter care hearing. And the parents will have a lawyer. If they win, that's it. The case is over, and the kids go home that day. However, if the parents lose, the agency basically takes control of the process. They will recommend to the judge when and under what circumstances the kids can go home. And judges tend to follow the agency's lead.
Teresa understands the stakes, but she's not convinced her attorney does. She had one brief phone conversation with him shortly after he was appointed. He told her then there wasn't much to discuss until he received discovery from Children's Services. That was weeks ago. Now, she's starting to panic. She has no idea what's going on with her case. She's been calling his office and sending emails, but no response. She finally hears from him a couple of days before the adjudication, and she gives him an earful.
I was ranting and raving about everything. I was talking about X, Y, and Z has happened. You know, and I don't understand why you're not taking me seriously. I need an attorney that's going to represent me and fight for me and my children. Do you have children? No, I don't. Okay, well, then you could have no idea what I'm going through right now or how I feel. But if you would just look at all this, you would realize that this is bogus. I need help. I mean, I just went off on him. He was like, from what you have sent me, it appears that we'll win this adjudication. I mean, he's just very...
He said that you were going to win the adjudication?
Yes.
In his opinion?
Yes.
August 8th rolls around. It's the day of the adjudication, and Teresa still has not met in person with her attorney. And, as she predicted, he still does not have the discovery.
Meaning, it's hard to see how he can possibly win at this trial that's literally about to take place.
But there's a stroke of good fortune. The court has not managed to serve the father of Teresa's two boys, Josiah and Azriel. Blake Fogle now lives in Florida, and no one can reach him. That means by law, they have to put an ad in a local paper and wait another month for him to respond.
The judge postpones the adjudication until September 2nd, and he tells Children's Services to send the discovery to Teresa's attorney, which they finally do.
So now Teresa and her attorney have another month to prepare. Of course, this also means Teresa is going to spend another month without her children. But at least now she can get ready to fight these allegations she feels are bogus.
During the next month, Teresa emails John Getson, her attorney, repeatedly. By his count, as many as 10 times a day. She's still trying to meet with them and go over all these documents she has that she believes disprove the allegations that were the basis for removing her children. But she can't get him to respond to her requests. So she finds herself an advocate, a woman named Becky Folks, who used to work in the Athens County Prosecutor's Office and now works for a domestic violence shelter.
Becky emails John on August 18th. It's a polite email, but it pretty much says, hey, you need to meet with your client.
John sends Teresa an email a little over an hour later, telling her to contact his office and set up a time for a meeting. He later insists Becky's email has nothing to do with the timing, but in any case, Teresa and John finally meet in person. Teresa says they go over her documents, and John tells her they have enough evidence to go ahead with a trial at the adjudication. She reminds him what is at stake.
Again, I asked him, you said you don't have any children, correct? He said, no. I said, okay, well, imagine that being your whole entire life and that being ripped away from you for no reason and you're walking around every day wondering what you've done so wrong to have for your children to be gone for no reason. And I was like, so you need to fight for me and my children.
The day of the adjudication comes, September 2nd, 2022.
By this time, Teo and I have learned a huge amount about the child welfare system. We've spoken with numerous experts, and they've choreographed for us exactly how they think this hearing is about to go down.
But there is a layer of uncertainty. By now, Teresa has shared Children's Services' discovery with us. We haven't seen any evidence to support most of the allegations against her. And that's making us wonder, did we miss something in all those hundreds and hundreds of pages we reviewed, all those interviews we conducted? Or else, what's going to happen if Teresa calls their bluff?
Now, that is a big if. Remember, a trial only happens at the adjudication if the parent asks for it, which then forces Children's Services to prove its allegations. Otherwise, the agency doesn't have to prove anything.
But if there's one person who wants to slug it out in court, it's probably Teresa.
Teresa arrives at the courthouse early. With her are her boyfriend, Tyler Tingley, Becky Folks, the advocate, and her friend and neighbor, Mimi Shuttleworth. They stand in the lobby outside the Athens County Juvenile Courtroom.
The adjudication is scheduled for 10:30. At 10:20, Teresa's attorney, John Getson, still hasn't arrived. Teresa checks the time. She's getting nervous. The minutes tick by. 10:27, 10:28, 10:29. People are filtering in and out of the courtroom.
John walks in at 10:31. He waves at Teresa, goes straight into the courtroom. A few minutes pass, and we see him emerge. He pulls Teresa aside.
The only words David or I can hear him say are, "The state has an offer." And it's in that moment we realize this is going exactly the way all those experts we interviewed said it would.
John whispers the details to Teresa. When she comes back to the group, there are tears in her eyes. The agency has agreed to return her girls. Not only that, but it will drop the abuse and neglect charges. There's just one condition. She has to agree to something called a dependency.
Now, David and I have spent the last month learning all about dependency. Many experts have already told us that if things don't go Teresa's way at this adjudication hearing, dependency may well be the cause, one way or another. But Teresa doesn't know what we know. Right now, in this moment, she thinks her kids are about to come home.
What Teo and I learned after speaking with multiple experts in child welfare is that whether or not there is a trial, the agency almost always walks out of the adjudication with custody of the children it has removed. Almost always. Despite the fact that the burden of proof at an adjudication trial is quite high and the rules of evidence are enforced. And that's due in large part to dependency.
We looked at the allegations against Teresa back in episode 3. One of the things we pointed out then was Children's Services really didn't need to show much evidence to clear the first court hearing.
Speaking with Josiah and Azriel, they also stated that Teresa has asked Josiah to get her marijuana in the past from his friends, and he has refused to do so, he has said. And they also stated that there isn't food in the home and that they are being evicted from the residence, even though they had just moved to the area in May.
That testimony from Jaislyn McGackey is hearsay. She's repeating what someone else told her outside of court and not under oath. Under normal circumstances, that doesn't fly in court, but the first hearing has relaxed rules of evidence. The adjudication does not, so no more "this is what I heard from somebody else." The agency needs hard evidence to prove its case if the parent demands a trial.
Except as you'll recall, the agency really doesn't have much evidence against Teresa. Or if they do, we never see it, and it isn't in the discovery Teresa gets from her attorney. So initially, Teo and I are genuinely curious to know how the agency is going to prove its case.
Well, until we learn about dependency.
Ohio's definitions of dependency, and there are many, include a child whose condition or environment is such as to warrant the state in the interests of the child in assuming the child's guardianship.
That's child welfare reform advocate Richard Wexler. He's quoting the Ohio Revised Code verbatim there.
So basically, dependency is, if I feel like it, I'll take the child. So it's no wonder agencies at the county level behave that way when state law basically gives them carte blanche.
His point is, look, that definition, a child whose condition or environment is such as to warrant the state in assuming the child's guardianship, is so broad that almost anything can be a dependency. And that means it's really, really easy to prove a dependency in court, because you can make it almost anything.
Now, Denise Ferguson, a public defender who represents parents in Cuyahoga County, does offer a caveat.
They have to show that whatever the dependency is negatively impacts the child. Sometimes they don't do that. And all the case law requires that. So many times it's not saying, well, you know, this action could be dependency. However, where's the negative impact on the child? If they can't show the negative impact, you should win.
But she says there are still plenty of cases where the dependency Children's Services alleges is pretty shallow.
It doesn't make sense, but I have seen dependencies where the children are dependent because dad was arrested, okay? Dad was let out of jail, but dad was arrested and away for 24 hours, okay? He bonds out. He's never done anything to the kids. The fact that he's facing criminal charges can result in a dependency. And the agency will argue there's a threat of harm because dad has been accused of being violent, a drug addict, or whatever. So until he rectifies that, the kids can't go home.
Or the imminent threat of serious harm.
Because dad has been accused in criminal court of getting in a bar fight or something. Therefore, dad's violent. We don't know if he's going to take it out on the kids. Not that he ever has in the past, but I've seen those types of arguments made.
That seems awfully speculative for imminent, emphasis on the imminent threat of serious harm.
Oh, I trust me, I get that, but I've seen those arguments made.
David is fixated on this question of imminent threat of serious harm because, if you'll recall from episode 2, Children's Services is only supposed to remove kids when there's an imminent threat of serious harm. That's the law in Ohio. And I think it's safe to say, David, that you do not find Ferguson's example with the dad in the bar fight persuasive.
Well, the examples we've gotten, from people in the system, mind you, of things that do rise to that level are, this child is in immediate danger. Someone might kill or seriously injure this child tonight, or maybe sometime this week, if we leave them in this home. And there's supposed to be an initial investigation that confirms this, and then some effort made to try to address the threat before the agency removes children. There is no clear evidence of an immediate danger to the child that I can see in the example Ferguson provided.
And if that example seems bizarre, here's one from Kelly Jellinger, a public defender in Erie County.
A dad was at a baseball game up in Michigan at the Detroit baseball game. And the guy comes around with the pop and the beer, right? And the guy, he says to the guy, my kid wants a lemonade. So the guy gives him a lemonade. He gave him a Mike's Hard Lemonade, right? Dad doesn't realize immediately that the kid's drinking a Mike's Hard Lemonade as opposed to, you know, iced tea lemonade, right? Sees it. And by the time he sees it, somebody's already called security because they see this little kid drinking a Mike's Hard Lemonade, right? They think dad gave it to him. That baby was snatched. He was brought home within 3 days, but they took him and they took his other kid too. Now they did thankfully do investigation and realize that's not what happened, that it was really the guy's fault for giving a 10-year-old a Mike's Hard Lemonade, right? But dad was like, oh my God. I mean, he's a prominent local person. I mean, anybody, even an accident, could result in a dependency claim. And that is a very scary situation.
Critics of the system argue dependency makes it much easier for children's services to target poor and non-white families. And the statistics bear that out, not only nationwide, but right here in Southeast Ohio.
What percent of parents who come into a shelter care hearing are indigent, need an attorney appointed?
You're venturing at 95 to 98%.
It's almost all of them.
Almost all of them. I think last year, I had 2 cases where attorneys were retained.
That's Athens County Juvenile Court Judge Zach Saunders telling us almost every single parent he sees is too poor to hire a lawyer. That is extremely unlikely to happen by chance.
Now, Saunders couldn't comment directly on Teresa's case, but we could ask him why he thinks the overwhelming majority of parents in his court are poor.
You know, abuse, neglect, dependency is not what I would say the allegations wouldn't be class specific, but you know, the data does show that the majority of individuals that come in here fall below the poverty line. And what I, you know, would say is that we need more services. We need to point them in the right direction or help them. It's not just saying sometimes that, you know, say that you were here and I was like, you should go use that service. I don't think that helps. Why not call or maybe call that agency or whoever it is and have them come in and meet with a client? I think there needs to be more of a proactive approach.
This is actually pretty reminiscent of what Scott Britton, the assistant director of the Public Children's Services Association of Ohio, told us a few episodes ago, that if we really want to help kids, we need more services, more supports, to keep families from falling into these desperate situations where removal is on the table.
Poor doesn't equal bad parent. It doesn't. And I personally, when I get involved with a case that involves an individual, whether it's housing, stability, food stability, I'll work tooth and nail to find resources with them.
That sounds great. But Saunders has a limited role in deciding who shows up in his courtroom for abuse, dependency, or neglect. Children's Services is the agency that brings him cases. And critics like Richard Wexler say, look, caseworkers are just as biased as the rest of us. Plenty of them, especially maybe newer ones, who, as we know, make up a lot of the child welfare workforce in Ohio, may feel uncomfortable around poverty. Caseworkers also wield a lot of power. So if they do feel uneasy around families living in poverty, well, that might help explain why almost all of these families in juvenile court are poor.
Even if everyone has the best of intentions, the almost infinitely elastic definition of dependency makes it very easy for agencies to take kids away for what amounts to symptoms of poverty.
We gave Saunders some examples of things that could really only be dependency as opposed to abuse or neglect. So, unstable housing, lack of food, two things which just so happen to be allegations against Teresa. Here's what he said.
No, I mean, those on a basis of itself don't really warrant for a removal. If there's other allegations that are present, you know, combined, that could be an issue.
That last part of what Saunders said is crucial. Alone, something like food or housing insecurity should not set a removal in motion. But if that insecurity is bundled with other allegations, maybe some abuse or neglect, then it's a very different situation. Because no matter how many allegations an agency throws at a parent to remove children, it only has to prove one, anyone, to win the adjudication. Here's public defender Kelly Jellinger again.
Abuse and neglect is actually harder to prove than dependency because they have to prove fault with abuse and neglect. They have to find a person at fault. In dependency, they do not. It is the no-fault provision.
In other words, dependency is the agency's ace in the hole.
You can almost always justify a dependency finding. Almost always. Because it's so general if there's testimony. You can almost always find it.
And this is why Children's Services almost always wins its adjudications. Because even if the abuse and neglect allegations are totally baseless, even if the whole imminent threat of serious harm just dissolves under scrutiny, Children's Services still has a dependency allegation to fall back on. A dependency that can be almost anything.
We asked Denise Ferguson, the public defender from Cuyahoga County, if she could explain to us why the system works like this.
It seems to us that if you can't prove the allegation that was the basis for removing the children, then why do you get to keep the children? Yes, you can prove some dependency, but the dependency didn't present imminent threat of serious harm. So why do you still get to keep the kids if they can't prove the allegations that were the basis for the removal?
Because sometimes the system isn't fair. I mean, there's no other way around it.
Ferguson estimates she wins about 10% of her adjudications. Jellinger said she wins 0%. Not a single one, even though she has years of experience and actively pushes back against the agency whenever she has the opportunity. It's just too easy to prove a dependency.
And that's if the parents decide to challenge the agency at the adjudication in the first place. Often, Children's Services uses dependency to leverage a deal.
My prosecutor, and most that I work with here in this part of the state, will say, you know what? You're right. I filed it as an abuse case. But if you admit to a dependency only, I will withdraw the abuse and neglect allegation. All my clients hear is they're not charging with abuse and neglect. That's all they hear. And I'm like, it doesn't really matter.
This is, of course, exactly what happened with Teresa, except as far as we're aware, her attorney actually encouraged her to take the deal.
There are times that I'm like, oh, no, 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 no. We got to take this to trial. But that's me because I'm geared up. I'm angry. But I have to remember this is my client's choice. And I have to remember that my client, if my client so chooses to enter into an admission, I'm kind of losing that opportunity to bring that up at an adjudication.
Denise Ferguson says she runs into this in Cuyahoga, too, not only from her clients, but from other attorneys.
I deal with it every day. I have attorneys that will say, we're just going to agree to dependency and temporary custody because why do we want to fight this?
Temporary custody meaning the agency keeps the kids.
We want to fight this because it's the right thing to do. It's hard to escape this conclusion. It really doesn't matter whether the allegations that result are true because the agency may never have to prove them. Because the agency will negotiate with the parent's attorney and try to get a stipulation. And if you stipulate, the agency is proving by clear and convincing evidence that they have a right to be involved.
That's a critical point Ferguson is making. If the parent takes a deal at the adjudication, that means there's no trial. The agency doesn't have to prove anything. And by taking the deal, the parent is now agreeing the agency had good reason to take their children, even if the allegations against them were not true. Once this is done, the parent can no longer challenge the agency's decision to remove the kids. And the agency no longer has to worry about justifying the removal in court.
Ferguson is calling out other defense attorneys there, and this is where another really important piece of the puzzle comes into play. See, Denise Ferguson and Kelly Jellinger, they're public defenders. That means their wages are paid by the state. They're right there in the courthouse, ready to jump in on day one, and whether they put 10 or 100 hours into a case, it really doesn't affect anything on their end because they're drawing a regular salary.
But most counties in Ohio do not have public defenders for juvenile court. Instead, most indigent parents in juvenile court get a court-appointed attorney.
I strictly represent parents. So we understand the seriousness of it, and we understand the ins and outs of it. Appointed counsel doesn't always take it as seriously because these are low money makers for them.
Court-appointed attorneys are paid hourly, and how much they can get paid for a case is capped. The numbers vary a little by county, but not by much. In Athens, a court-appointed lawyer in an abuse dependency neglect case will earn $100 an hour up to a maximum of $1,500. That comes out to 15 hours of work before they stop earning money on a case.
When you're paying an office staff and everything else, and if you can charge $300 an hour on a divorce, these cases get short shipped from a lot of people and a lot of attorneys. And if you're appointed counsel, you don't want to make the judges mad because then they won't appoint you. That type of thing goes away with the public defender's office because we don't necessarily have to worry about that.
Richard Wexler's take on this is unambiguous.
A family in this situation will get about as much help from a cardboard cutout in a three-piece suit as they're going to get from the court-appointed lawyer. Now, sometimes that's because the lawyer doesn't care. Often it's because the lawyer cares a lot, but is so overloaded and deluged with cases that he has no time to mount an effective defense.
And this matters even though winning the adjudication is almost impossible, because there are other ways that good lawyers can help parents get their kids back.
We talked about this a bit in episode 3 with the shelter care hearing, but it comes into play throughout the case. For example, there are various motions defense attorneys can file if they believe the Children's Services Agency isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing. One of the things we learned in months of reporting on this issue is that it's really up to the defense attorney to hold the agency accountable. Here's Kelly Jellinger again.
The caseworker was not doing what I thought she should do. I went to the prosecutor. I went to JFS. We tried to work it out. They basically told me, it's our policy. We can do what we want. Okay. So I filed a motion to show cause on the caseworker. And all of a sudden, things changed. All of a sudden, it wasn't a policy of the agency anymore. Okay. But again, that compelling them to do things. For example, reunification, motion to file reunification, motion to terminate the case plan and end the case and reunify the children, motion for reasonable efforts. The client has done everything. The agency still is not returning these children, making them have to lose their funding. All of those types of things can be done.
But they take time, and they don't always work. Jellinger says success often comes down to having a judge or magistrate who won't just play it safe, quote-unquote, by leaving children with the agency.
That is a problem systematically, I think, with children's services cases. Judges don't want to upset that apple cart. When you read all of the research on these sorts of things, that is generally, judges don't want to upset the apple cart. Judges have come to accept that unacceptable behavior is okay. They don't understand why it's so crucial that families not be separated. And, oh, poor Susie caseworker, she's tried, but she just couldn't get it done, but she's not doing it maliciously, you know, that sort of argument.
All this to say, fighting the agency is hard and time-intensive. And if you're a court-appointed lawyer making $1,500 max on a case, hard and time-intensive doesn't work. Which is why most just encourage their client to take a deal and cooperate fully with the agency.
Teresa's attorney, John Getson, is court-appointed. And Teresa's experience seems typical of what it's like to have appointed counsel. She and John rarely meet. He does none of the things Jellinger describes. He basically just tells Teresa to sit tight.
Remember how John wouldn't meet with Teresa until after he got discovery from Children's Services? Well, Ferguson and Jellinger both say they would meet with clients as soon as possible, regardless of whether discovery has been received yet. And they would keep pressure on the prosecutor to deliver the discovery on time.
We asked Jellinger how she would react if she got discovery and there was basically nothing of substance in it, nothing to support the allegations justifying the removal.
What if you received discovery from the county and with respect to some allegations, there's simply nothing in the discovery that goes to the allegations? It's just not there. And yet, the way the system is supposed to work, someone is supposed to be investigating the allegations made, right? But what if that's just not in the discovery?
So if that did not exist, my red flags would be going off. I would be questioning the existence of that, okay? Questioning why that isn't there. But I'd be waiting till they got on the stand under oath to ask those questions, right? Because one of a couple things could be happening. Either they truly have not investigated, right? And it's just not there. They're hiding it. Or they have failed to produce it to their own attorney because of laziness or incompetence or whatnot. Or they failed to document it. Okay? All of which are inappropriate on so many different levels. So if I've gotten discovery and nothing is included in there, I would be telling my client, hey, I think we need to have a hearing. I think this does not show what is called reasonable efforts to prevent removal.
Teresa's attorney doesn't do that.
In an email to us many months after the adjudication, John Getson writes that he believed there was enough evidence for Children's Services to prove a dependency. He doesn't identify what that was, citing attorney-client privilege. But in his view, the best thing he could do for Teresa was to make a deal with the agency and encourage her to be as accommodating as possible.
Not an easy task where Teresa was concerned.
No, but that's also why he didn't challenge the agency over the missing case plan. He believed that would just slow things down more.
In his emails to Teresa, John is a bit more circumspect. In one email dated August 18th, 2022, so after he gets discovery, before the rescheduled adjudication, he tells Teresa they can, quote, still win, unquote. As far as Teresa is concerned, winning means winning. Case closed. Agency loses. Kids come home. But John's email to us suggests he was always planning to cut a deal with the agency.
We don't know exactly what John says to Teresa in the courthouse on September 2nd at the adjudication, but we do know how Teresa perceives it. And what she understands, what clinches the deal for her, is that her girls will be home in a week or two.
Rylan, Teresa's older daughter, is about to turn 10. Teresa wants her and her younger sister Everly home ASAP. So she agrees. She will accept a finding of dependency to make that happen. And when she does that, whether she realizes it or not, she's agreeing that the agency had the right to take her children.
That acceptance is all Judge Saunders hears when they go back into the courtroom. The parties have made a deal, so he sets the date for hearing number 3, the disposition.
At the disposition, and at every subsequent hearing, the judge decides what to actually do with the children. Do they stay with the agency? Can they go back home with protective supervision? Should the case be closed?
While the judge is the arbiter of the process, Children's Services are really the ones seen as the experts. Their recommendations tend to set the tone for the judge's decisions. That's not always the case, but as attorney Kelly Gellinger said a while back, many judges do not want to upset the apple cart.
Now, there is a guiding framework for how this is supposed to happen. Children's Services is supposed to actively pursue reunification. That's where the kids eventually go home to their parents. And the agency is supposed to produce a written document explaining what needs to happen before reunification occurs. You've already heard about this document. It's called a case plan.
Something the agency in Teresa's case should have, by law, filed within 30 days after the removal, but which it did not.
Yeah, they're supposed to start working on the case plan right after the shelter care hearing.
And all this matters because as soon as Children's Services removes kids, a timer starts. In Ohio, it's known as 12 of 22, or 12 of the last 22 months. If a child has been in agency custody for 12 of the last 22 months, the agency can petition the judge to terminate parental rights.
At which point, dear parents, they're not your children anymore. They're going up for adoption.
That's why the stakes are so high even after the adjudication, and why it's so important to have a good lawyer, even if you probably won't win outright at a trial. Because if you don't get your kids back fast enough, you may lose them permanently.
Oh, and there's one other thing. That case plan that's supposed to be the guide for how you get your kids back, even if you as a parent follow that, you still might not get your kids back. Public defender Denise Ferguson says there are a variety of objections Children's Services might raise.
We don't think you benefited from any of the services on the case plan. You're not bonded to your kids. Your kids don't want to go home. They've adjusted so well where they're at. We think they should remain there.
We would be remiss if we did not mention a couple checks in the system that are supposed to counteract what Ferguson is talking about. Those are CASAs and GALs.
CASAs are court-appointed special advocates. GALs are guardians ad litem. And both are supposed to be neutral parties representing the child's best interests. Not part of Children's Services, not on the side of the parents.
Which sounds like a fine idea. And Judge Zach Saunders is enthusiastic about his CASAs.
So CASA obviously is advocating for the best interest of the child. They are a middle party. They're known to speak up sometimes in cases when Children's Services doesn't want to, or the parents don't want to, or it's a sensitive subject that sometimes everybody beats around the bush, but they don't talk about the real subject why we're here. And my volunteers do an excellent job of bringing that to my attention. And what I also appreciate when they're sitting in these emergency hearings or these shelter care hearings, they ask sometimes those hard questions of like, hey, have they done this? Or hey, have they done that? And it opens the door to maybe finding a solution that wasn't thought of.
Critics, however, say CASA programs are rife with problems of their own. Here's reform advocate Richard Wexler.
What are the qualifications to be a CASA? None, basically. You have to be able to afford to give your time, and then you get 30 hours of training and a little in-service. Who can be a CASA? Not a poor person working two jobs to make ends meet, clearly. They don't have time. The only people who can be CASAs are affluent people who can afford the time. And that's going to skew white. And it will generally skew female. So it's the ideal of motherhood, the white middle-class mom. And the idea is that is the norm, and that is the qualification, your white middle-class status. I mean, if 30 hours is all it takes, what do we need law schools and social work schools for? And sure enough, here's the thing. You look at the data, study after study has found that CASA prolongs foster care, reduces chances of reunification, increases the chances of kids aging out. But it satisfies the CASAs so much. It makes them feel so good. It's a perfect example of a system of help that helps the helpers.
We also spoke with a woman named Jane Novick about this. She used to direct the CASA program in Ohio's Montgomery County.
Really, the system needs to be dissolved. I don't believe you can fix this system.
Years of working in the system have left Novick pretty disillusioned. She feels it is too heavily weighted in favor of children's services.
Unfortunately, a lot of times people will err on believing children's services over families. You know, there's a whole stereotypical assumption. Oh, if a parent used drugs or they live in a neighborhood that's not deemed safe, how credible could they be? I think there's some of that. I'm not going to say what all the time, but, you know, that goes on. I will tell you that when some of my CASAs saw a problem with children's services, it was next to impossible to do too much about it.
And echoing some of Wexler's criticism, she feels diversity training for CASAs is sorely lacking.
We needed a much better training on cultural, racial, religious differences than the usual, let's all love each other. You have to somehow find a way to get people to understand you can't look from your perspective. You have to take a step back.
We put some of those concerns to Saunders. He said he still thinks the Athens County CASA program does a good job and trusts them not to succumb to bias.
I don't see that with the volunteers, and I wouldn't allow if it dealt with just, you know, some form of poverty. My CASAs are ones that think outside the box of how to fix that problem, if that's the problem, rather than, you know, turn the other way or look at it as a detriment to a parent.
We did reach out multiple times to the Athens CASA GAL program, but they never returned our calls.
We'll end this episode back in the courthouse immediately after the adjudication, where everything has suddenly fallen apart.
So they're not going to be home until after, in a likelihood, because of what was just said in court. I would not be legally permitted to move forward with moving the girls back to your home.
That's Teresa talking with her new caseworker, a woman named Rebecca Inbedin. Rebecca is explaining that Teresa's kids won't be coming home until the disposition in mid-October, which is not what Teresa thought was going to happen.
As it turns out, Rylan and Everly's father, Justin Johns, was also worried about his girls. And he was frustrated about the sheer impenetrability of children's services. So he decided to take things into his own hands. He announced at the adjudication hearing that he planned to file for custody himself.
This apparently throws a wrench in everything. All of a sudden, children's services says it can't bring the girls home to Teresa. They have to do a home study. There's a whole process.
Teresa is furious. As far as she's concerned, the agency and her own attorney have just lied to her. But there's nothing she can do. The ink has dried. She has stipulated to a dependency and forfeited her right to challenge the allegations against her.
Teresa later writes several angry emails to her attorney telling him to withdraw her dependency plea. He writes back that she shouldn't do that because it will only slow things down. At one point he writes, quote, "The easiest way to get your kids back is to continue to progress in the case plan, get evidence together to show why you should have custody, and continue to work with CPS so that they can recommend the same to the court. Getting them on our side would be greatly beneficial," unquote.
CPS being Children's Services, an agency Teresa does not trust and does not particularly want on her side. But once again, she finds herself with few other options.
In our next episode, we'll catch up with Teresa's son, Asriel. Teresa hasn't heard from him for most of the summer. When she finally does, it's not good news. That's next time on 150 Days. 150 Days is a production of WOUB Public Media. The podcast was written and produced by Teo Peck Suzuki and David Forster. Adam Rich is the audio engineer. Music by Caitlin Kraus and Brad Swinarski. To read the digital version of this story, go to woub.org/150-days.